Welcome to Louisiana Lefty, a podcast about politics and community in Louisiana, where we make the case that the health of the state requires a strong progressive movement fueled by the critical work of organizing on the ground. Our goal is to democratize information, demystify party politics, and empower you to join the mission, because victory for Louisiana requires you. Thank you for listening to season one of the podcast. I'm your host, Linda Woolard, and I want to welcome you to season two. We started this podcast in the middle of a pandemic, in the backdrop of Georgia voters flipping the Senate blue, insurrectionists rioting at the Capitol, and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris being sworn in as president and vice president of the United States. We remain in a volatile time. My audio producer and I have rarely been in the same room with one another. I've conducted all my interviews remotely. Still, over the months, I've learned some things about the various components of podcasts. My producer and I have found better ways of working together, and we've invested in upgraded equipment, searching to create an improved listener experience. Those changes will continue in season two. What will stay consistent is the mission of Louisiana Lefty. We state it at the start of every episode. The conversations we conduct with Democrats, progressives, and community leaders are meant to help spread information across the state, essentially giving our allies access to insider info from consultants, elected officials, campaign veterans, and of course, organizers. We also hope to provide insight from the different constituencies across Louisiana that are needed to make up winning coalitions for the left in the South. While our discussions are inherently framed by the times in which they're recorded, our content is meant to be evergreen and will therefore be archived for you to reference again and again on our website, louisianalefty.rocks. Further, we're in the process of adding transcripts to all our episodes so you can more readily find specific pieces of information when you need it. Before we leap forward into season two, let's look back at just a few of our highlights from season one of Louisiana Lefty. We were lucky to land an interview with Alexandria native Varsha Sharma, who was a reporter and managing editor at Now This News at the time. Shortly after, Varsha was recruited to be editor-in-chief of the politically influential Teen Vogue. Part of our conversation on the media touched on both-siderism and false equivalencies. Here's Varsha's take on that.
I think we've seen a lot of progress on that. I feel like I'm using that word so much today, but I mean, that's if not on Louisiana Lefty, when is the time that I will use the word progress over and over again? But truly, we have seen progress on that in media in recent years, not as much as like I think you or I would like to see. But we've also seen a divide between the legacy, older, more traditional institutions and the new media startups like Now This and like other organizations, where you're more likely to see the New York Times make a both sides argument or false equivalency than you are to see Now This do it. I mean, that's one of the things that sets us apart from the New York Times. So I have been on a crusade against false equivalence in journalism from the beginning. It is, you know, a huge passion of mine in that regard, because I do feel like that has contributed to the factual decline of American democracy, is this increasing polarization that we've seen between the parties, the increase in misinformation and disinformation, as you were just asking about, combined with the idea that reporters or news organizations should give equal weight to both sides. And Republican Congress member said X and Democrat Congress member said Y, but the article doesn't tell you which one is true or which one is based in reality or has science that backs it up. That's not helpful to anybody. It's not helpful to readers, to American citizens, to people who are voting for these policymakers. So it's harmful. I think it can be harmful to journalism and the journalism mission of informing the public. And it's harmful to democracy. It's not necessarily the best or most effective way at educating an electorate either. So I agree with you. I think it's still a problem. We're getting a little bit better, but we're not quite there yet.
We had a great conversation with our first ever Organizer of the Month awardee, Nema Savage of Color of Change Pack, and I asked her what she thinks makes a good organizer. Here's what Nema said.
The number one thing is to listen. Like, you just have to listen to people. You have to ask some questions to get people talking sometimes, but you mostly just have to listen and have good, solid conversations with folks. That's where any good organizing relationship I've had has started, with like a chit chat. You know, I remember when I first started kind of formally organizing with Fight for 15, I would sit in my car outside of a McDonald's and I would really have to like give myself a pep talk, like, come on, girl, just go in there and just talk to someone. Or sometimes it's just going there and like, you know, check out, see what people are dealing with at work, right? Like, yeah, that manager just, you know, didn't treat that cashier nice at all. Or, you know, this cashier is running from behind the register to go to the parking lot and like sweep up, doing like 20 jobs and making 7 1/4. So I would have to really work myself up to put away the shy part of myself and kind of just be personable with people and really just keeping it real. Like, you just got to be real. You got to not be like, you know, code switching and acting like somebody you're not and trying to be like all of these things. You just got to be real and you really just got to listen. I think that that's what brings people in, and connecting with people on real issues that like most of the people I talk to when organizing, and I'm going to just use 515 as an example. Most of the people I talk to, like, the pay actually wasn't the issue. It was that they did not feel respected at work. And so I couldn't force that on them. Like, yes, this is called, the campaign is Fight for 15, but I can't force you to like actually be all about, hey, I want $15 as a minimum wage. But if you want dignity and respect in the workplace, you deserve that too, right? Like, if you think you should be paid for being the custodian and the cashier, then yes, you should. And so really just like listening, but you have to listen to people to hear that, to hear what their issue really is, and not, you know, approach someone with your agenda, right? Of like what you think we should be fighting for. Because at the end of the day, I wasn't working at a fast food restaurant at the time, though I have in the past, I wasn't at the time. And so I could not tell someone what their issue could or should be, right? Mothers were most concerned that, you know, they had crazy schedules and could never predict when they would need childcare. That was the issue. It wasn't about 7 1/4, right? And so I think those things make a good organizer, like just listening and just being yourself and like just keeping it a buck with people. I say a buck, 100, you know.
Well, and I think I hear you say also being able to have a level of empathy and caring for people mm-hmm. in the situations they're in.
Yeah. And a lot of it, like, you know, a lot of it, like, we can reflect and see in our own lives too, or in that of people we love. And that allows us to really like lean into that, that empathy. I think also, like, you know, being a good organizer is like thinking about the things that get people excited and bring people together and empower people to feel ready to fight. Right. And so, you know, here in New Orleans, like, our strike lines look very different. Our actions look very different than a lot of other places. We knew that some good food and a bomb brass band would get everybody going. Every single person would come and say, yes, fight for 15. Like, we need 15 as minimum wage. But those things were like entry points for people, right? And entry points to leadership don't always look like, you know, speaking at a rally or, you know, telling your story at a meeting. Sometimes that entry point is this warm meal or this bomb second line that's going to bust through the French Quarter and through the front doors of a McDonald's, right? Like, sometimes the entry point is those things. Is someone seeing that second line through their neighborhood and hopping off the bus and following it, don't know where it's going. And those things are key too, like those cultural points that like really grab people at the heart, you know, and get people's feet moving and minds going and in community with each other, is the real secret sauce of organizing.
We spoke to leaders of the College Democrats to find out what motivates young voters to engage at a higher level, because if they fully harnessed their electoral power, they could swing all kinds of elections. Here's what Brooks Fordham had to say.
I think young voters care a lot about policy. They are really care about like what specific policies a candidate or candidates are advocating for them to vote for someone. So if you're running for office and feel like most younger voters, you know, lean left on a lot of issues, but just because they lean left doesn't necessarily mean that they want to vote for a Democrat. And I think that it's Democrats talking about issues and tangible policies that we can pass that really excites young voters, like college affordability and student debt. You know, I think that's one that a lot of young people really like to hear, which I think is like a two-part issue, is dealing with college debt. Some people want to cancel some debt. Some people want to cancel all of it. That's a debate that's going on in the party. But then also after that, canceling debt or getting rid of it is only one part of the solution, because then we have to still make college affordable, or else we'll be in the same problem for 20 or 30 years from now. We'll be in the exact same situation we're in now. That's an issue that young voters really care about. I think climate change, specifically in a state like Louisiana, young people are very worried about. I mean, we just saw just this past week, all the flooding from Lake Charles to Baton Rouge. You see these homes that are being flooded, these streets and bridges, and it's just terrible. It just speaks about how, and it's not even hurricane season yet. It just shows how bad the weather's getting, climate's getting, climate change is definitely real and happening. And I feel like young people want our elected officials to take a serious stand against it, because we are going to be here for a very long time and we're gonna have to deal with the effects of it.
Over the course of the first season, we spoke to several experts and insiders who have a track record of wins in electoral politics. And they shared important information for potential candidates and campaign staff. For instance, veteran communications maven Kirsten Alvin-Attakas shared these salient points about messaging.
There are lots of resources out there for folks who are thinking about running or thinking about, you know, helping a campaign. One of those resources is the Voicing Our Values Guide, which is by the Public Leadership Institute. And I'm sure Linda will provide the link to that in the podcast notes or something like that. But it's this wonderful guide that teaches how to communicate effectively through values. And the main values that they discuss are freedom, it's fairness, and it's also security. And those are things that are universal, probably everywhere in the world, but they're certainly universal here in America. There are ways to talk about issues without sacrificing our progressive values. There's a way to talk about defunding the police, but still talking about security, right? Because everyone wants to be safe and secure in their communities. Do you think everybody feels safe and secure in their communities right now, the way that law enforcement is being handled? No. But by starting talking about shared values, that allows you to communicate effectively with swing voters, independent voters, and even Republican voters, where you're starting from a place of common ground rather than immediately starting with from a place of opposition, because that just creates, you know, everybody digging in their heels. So check that out, Voicing Our Values. And it'll be interesting for those of you who are fans of Pete Buttigieg. You will find a lot in that book that sounds familiar. He's one of the people that I think has ingested that book and just exudes it now. Smart guy. But he talks about why he's a Democrat. I think he talks about four F's, which is freedom, fairness, family, and the future, which, you know, it kind of incorporates all of those values that are in this book. But so if you like how Pete Buttigieg goes on Fox News and kind of ethers them, he gets a lot of that training, I think, comes from work with this Voicing Our Values Guide. So that's number one. Number two is, and there's a lot of resources on the internet for this. It's called, Marshall Gans came up with it. It's called The Public Narrative. So you start with your story of self, and then you move to the story of us and the story of now. But for candidates, especially if you're running at a local level and you're not going to you're not going to do polling, you're not going to do focus groups, you're not going to do any of that, but you're trying to figure out, okay, so what am I supposed to be saying when I'm running for office? Your message is you. That is the message. Your story is self. You want to talk about why you were drawn to this work, what you hope to accomplish. And by talking about yourself, and I, you know, as a woman, I know that's challenging sometimes, but it's a practice that helps you kind of drill down into, again, why you do this work and why people will be drawn to you and want to participate and help you in this work by seeing your shared values.
At the end of our interviews, I asked three questions, the first two of which varied slightly depending on the topic our guest was addressing. Here are some examples of the range of answers to those important questions, starting with Ashley Shelton, Executive Director of the Power Coalition, and her thoughts on the civic possibilities in Louisiana.
Oh gosh, that's a tough one. So, I mean, I think one of the, I think one of the hurdles is that, you know, we've got to do more, kind of leadership development work. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, we do a lot of education work, I always tease folks, is that, you know, folks won, they won the election, but that doesn't mean that they have a real analysis of what's happening in our community. And so for me, it's just really like, how are we developing leaders? What's that pipeline look like? And then also too, that leaders that know on the front end that they actually have to be accountable, and what does accountability actually look like, and what does it mean? And so I think that that's the challenge that we've got to continue to work on. And you know, we've got some great leaders, elected leaders around our state that I'm proud to know and work with. And then some that make me want to pull my hair out. So we got to get to that place where we're building a strong pipeline of leaders that are accountable to the people of the state. I would say our greatest opportunity, I think that, you know, Louisiana has always kind of been a little bit of an anomaly in the Deep South. And so I think that there's an opportunity. I mean, you know, we've got the only progressive governor in the Deep South. We've got Medicaid expansion. You know, we've been able to do some things that have certainly progressed and supported and helped our state and the people of our state. And I think that we need to continue to push and break down the issues from the perspective of what's real and what's not. You know, I think a great example was, you know, kind of the fake tort reform that had to happen during a special session in the midst of a, you know, humanitarian crisis and pandemic. and the reality was that what we really needed was help for our people that were hurting because of the pandemic and its impact on jobs. And so how do we help our people, understand these issues more specifically and outside of the context of partisan politics? Like, I don't care what letter is behind your, you know, what letter you vote. What I care about is, you know, like when we talk to people in community, we agree on more than we disagree. And we agree on what some of the solutions are and what's necessary. And so I think that for me, it's like, how do we actually get these issues front and center and get the work done versus kind of, you know, fighting, you know, across the aisle all the time. And the people are the folks that ultimately lose to special interest. And so, you know, for me, I always say that, like, you know, we've built this really nice car in terms of organizations and infrastructure in our state that's doing really amazing work, building movement and power and voice. And people are truly the engine of that really nice car. And so if we want that, you know, that car to continue to move and, like I said, build movement and power, then, you know, like we've got to make sure that we're, you know, bringing people to the table and continuously including them in those conversations. And we're certainly a proud, proud to be a part of that and making sure that people continue to be the engine and get more involved and fight for the kind of state they want to live in. And so I always say everything I love is in this place. And so I'm going to fight for it.
Answering from a Democratic perspective is former legislative candidate in dark red Livingston Parish, Robin Parrott.
I think the misperception of who Democrats are and what their values are, and being organized, getting people on the ground. I think I've been dying since my campaign to have conversations with voters again. And of course the pandemic happened, but I said during the campaign, I'm gonna continue this. This is what needs to happen. We have to talk about the issues. We have to get people engaged in that and to care about it. And I think having those conversations is like the top thing that we have to do. We have to train people to have those conversations because not everybody can do that effectively. I know I had volunteers that said, well, if they tell me that they're for Trump, I'm going to tell them off. And I'm like, you can't do that. You can't. So it has to be something that they feel like they're listening, deep, deep canvassing, not, 30-second conversation. This is something that we would have to focus on issues. And so getting organized to do that and having enough people and having people that are motivated enough to care about that, I think that's a hurdle that we have to cross.
What are the biggest opportunities for the Democratic Party in Louisiana?
I think bringing younger people in would be something. It's going to happen because obviously generations are changing over. And so we just have to make sure that we're reaching out to them, that they know about us. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do in Livingston Parish is just letting them know that we exist, that we're here. Did you know that there's a Democratic Party out here? Would you like to get involved? How would you like to do that? And trying to find engaging ways, which is hard, I would say, in a rural area because young people are more in the city and there's not places that you can just say, let's go find the young people, you know, like a college town. But I think in the whole of Louisiana, we should be targeting the colleges and the high schools, stuff like that.
And again, here's Varsha Sharma talking about the American political system.
Our biggest hurdle is that I think roughly 33% of Americans, or at least American adults, American voters, are okay with some strain of authoritarianism. And that has been crystallized during the Trump years. And I think they've been there in some form for, you know, the entirety of this country's history. We talk about Jim Crow laws and the Voting Rights Act and going back to segregation before that. It's always been a problem. But I think there is also a strain of the electorate that is increasingly disconnected from reality in ways that we haven't seen. Thinking about QAnon people, thinking about various conspiracy theories. And these conspiracy theories were never mainstreamed at the highest levels as they have been in the Republican Party and the Trump administration in recent years. So we have a big fight and challenge ahead of us to continue protecting democracy and championing it, because we're gonna have to. It's not, you know, I think Obama has said something like this, it's not, and the late John Lewis as well, that you have to fight for democracy constantly. It's not just something you can take for granted, or you can let it sit there and leave it alone and assume that it will be okay. That's never going to be the case.
Well, that sort of probably leads into your answer to this question, although I shouldn't say that before I ask it. So for the same topic, American political system, what's our biggest opportunity?
Oh, I love that. I think at least in my lifetime, there has never been more interest in politics and policy. I think more people are paying attention to politics than ever before, and not just national, presidential, congressional level races, but the pandemic and the climate crisis, I think, have really crystallized for people how important local races are. Criminal justice reform, the Black Lives Matter movement, the fact that it's your local DAs or prosecutors who affect police accountability. I just think there's such increased public interest in local races. And I think that is our biggest opportunity for education and for pushing for progress going forward is, okay, we have a great inflection point where more people than ever before are paying attention. Let's not lose this opportunity. Let's use it as a teachable moment to show people this is what it's like to have functional government during a pandemic. This is how it can change your life and help you and you know, change things for the better instead of worse.
And we'll close with three different answers, on what the obstacles and opportunities for progressives in Louisiana are, starting with Gabby Goldstein of Sister District.
Gabby, what do you think are the biggest obstacles for progressives in our country right now?
Well, I mean, you know, I would just go back to something that I talked about a little earlier, which is the narrative around the role of states and how progressives think about states as a, in relation to civil rights and human rights and progressive policy. And we have to, just like we were saying about the portfolio of volunteering, there's also in our minds, we need to have a portfolio of advocacy and levers of power as we're building towards our progressive goals. And it can't all just, we can't put all of our eggs into the federal basket. We really have to invest some of our time and our energy into making the positive case for state policy. And it's critically important because we're not starting from much. There is not much of a narrative out there about the positive power of states. We have focused as progressives so much on federal policy, federal answers, federal. And it's not one or the other. We have to do both. And I see that as a big hurdle from a narrative perspective, is getting folks aligned and excited about fighting for states, because we have this ingrained notion that that's a conservative strategy. It's not. It's not a it's only a conservative strategy because we have not exercised that muscle, but we have to do it. And so that is my challenge to all of us, is to think more expansively about the role of states and the ways in which state policy and state politics can be a force for good, and how important it is that we focus on that too.
So if I were to ask then what our biggest opportunities as progressives are, is that what you're going to say, is getting involved at the state level?
It is. I do. I mean, and the truth is, it's because of that return on investment that I mentioned. You know, these are bite-sized races where we can actually really have a big impact. At Sister District, it's very typical for us to end up raising 40% of our candidate's entire budget. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower. Last year, we did an average of, you know, something like 40% of all of the phone calls that our candidates made during their entire campaign. You know, and we had win margins for some of our candidates of 140 votes or 47 votes. So you can really see the impact of the work that you're doing at this level, because the margins are so small, and because your $20 really goes a long way. So I see it as a huge opportunity for us to focus on states and to focus on having a long-term strategy of building power at this level. Brick by brick, we can get there.
Here's political strategist and media consultant Wesley Baez.
The biggest obstacle, in my opinion, for progressives is being able to come together with a shared vision as it relates to electoral work. I think that there's really strong organizations, particularly statewide, that have been able to come together with a shared vision for what the values and issues should be. But, you know, what I have not seen, I think, like even sort of some of what I saw in this past congressional race, is we have not been able to nail down what does that electoral structure look like for progressives and radical Democrats, and how can we make sure that they're consistently nurtured, right, to make sure that we have candidates that are able to run earlier with more funding support, with more communication support. So I think, like, the challenge, what I see, is making sure we're building a electoral structure that can match the issue and advocacy structure that I'm seeing and has been built since Hurricane Katrina.
That's smart. And what do you think is the biggest opportunity for progressives in Louisiana?
I think, honestly, it is sort of at the moment, the continued existence of, until we get close primaries, the jungle primaries, right? If you use and run smart new school campaigns, you can figure out, like, in some places, I might only need 30 or 35% and I can make a runoff and get across the line, right? I think the other opportunity, you know, you asked for one, but the second one I would say is there's a number of seats that John Bell won that, like, Republicans are in, right? And these are seats that were not contested in the legislative time that I think like progressives should take shots at, right? Don't be afraid to run in these kinds of seats because you're building out that Democratic base. You're pulling out as many voters as possible. And depending on what your message is, particularly if it's like economic based, you can pull in some independents, right? So I think those are the opportunities. I think there are ways in the jungle primary, depending on how the electorate and the people you're running against work, like there's opportunities to win there, but leave no seat open, right? Every seat should have somebody running against it. And every time a progressive runs for office and they put out a message that articulates the values that, you know, as somebody who's close to a democratic socialist, right, that articulate these values, you're putting it into the mainstream, right? Once again, you win campaigns through repetition of a message that means something to voters. And we are consistently talking about a $15 minimum wage. We're consistently talking about unionizing. And we're consistently talking about economic and social and criminal justice reform. And we keep telling stories and we keep meeting voters. We may not win the first elections, but eventually people are going to say, huh, you know what? Linda's right. We should elect her to city council because these are the issues that are like happening, right? So it's about repetition. It's not just about picking spots. It's about taking every single opportunity that's available and maximizing it for as much as it can for the longer goal of building electoral power to win.
Finally, consultant, strategist, and former executive director of the Louisiana Democratic Party, Stephen Handwerk.
The biggest obstacle, I think, is purity tests. I think that if we're going to have people try and live up to a standard, heck, I don't agree with my husband on everything. How in the world are we going to try and put people through some sort of massive purity test in order to get them? So I think that that's our biggest obstacle right now, that we've got to figure out a way to navigate.
And what's our biggest opportunity?
I think our biggest opportunity is the issues. If we refocus the conversations and we set the conversation rather than letting others set the conversation, we're going to be winning. We have the issues on our side.
Succinct and well stated.
And because we lift up organizers as superheroes on Louisiana Lefty, we play with that iconography throughout our podcast. And we end our episodes asking the guest who their favorite superhero is. I think former Senator J.P. Morrell had some pretty good thoughts on superheroes when I asked him this question. So I want to open our final segment in the review with his comments.
My voracious reading habit, my immense vocabulary comes from reading comic books. And I mean, I read other books now, obviously, too. But that when I was a kid, like I was always reading comics. And then as I got older, I really began to understand the depth to which comic books tackle huge social justice issues. It's funny because like this is just a lead in to whatever your next question is, but like people don't understand how important it was when Stan Lee created Black Panther. When Stan Lee created Black Panther, it was the middle of the civil rights movement, and the term Black Panther in itself was incendiary. And Stan Lee created a character who was an African superhero from the most advanced country in the world, in Africa. And I mean, it was a way for people, before they even knew about civil rights as children, they were normalized the fact that you can have an African person be ridiculously intelligent from a super technological space who's a leader of people. Like, comic books are tremendously subversive when it comes to progressive ideology. I mean, right now, people are losing their minds over the fact that Coates is writing Captain America right now. And it's because Captain America, in the current run, he's vilifying internet memes and internet groups and parallels to like the Proud Boys and how they're the new Red Skull, to the point where you have conservative pundits who are complaining to Marvel that he's calling Proud Boys Nazis. And it's like, they are the new Nazis that Captain America is going to punch in the face. But I was in the comics before I understood them, but after I understood them, I was like, wow, these are great. Like, this just was my place.
And finally, Here are a few of those answers to the question, who's your favorite superhero?
Ooh, who's my favorite superhero? That's a good one.
Oh, Wonder Woman, obviously. Black Panther.
I'm a big Batman fan.
You know, I really enjoyed reading Watchmen when I was a kid. And during the pandemic, we watched the HBO series. And I was just so struck by that miniseries. I thought it was breathtaking. I thought it was so well done. And it just addressed these complexity of issues in such a nuanced way. And the character that I was most obsessed with was Angela Abar, Sister Knight.
My favorite superhero, that's a very interesting question. I just watched all of the Marvels, and I have surmised that I am a huge fan of the Hulk, and that's just where I am. He has my heart.
And I love Daredevil because on a basic level, he is a differently abled superhero, probably one of the first, because he's a blind person who is a superhero. So on that level, he's very interesting. That's like a one level. Then you go a level above it. He is a personification of the idea of justice. The whole idea behind his creation, when Stan Lee created Daredevil, he was literally inspired by the idea that justice is blind. So he created a blind lawyer who is a superhero.
My favorite superhero is Black Panther, right? And I say that because I believe in Afrofuturism. I believe in, even when we talked a little bit earlier about sort of the George Floyd stuff, I understand and live in the world that we are now, and I want to make sure that we can live in this, but it's important for all of us, but I think especially for Black people in America, to be able to vision a future that we cannot see yet. And to see a man, especially, we miss you, Chadwick Boseman, you the man, see Black Panther to run a technologically advanced Black country that loved itself and everything that was about, that's a future I want to get to. I want to be able to make sure that Black folk and brown people and the new American majority, but everybody can live liberated and free and full of love and have the opportunities that they want. And I feel like he as a superhero, that movie, that message, that's everything I want to be.
You know, family is really important to me. I've thought about this, you know, growing up, I was a big fan of the Fantastic Four. and they were just so cool to me. You know, they represented pretty much every power that you needed to defeat the enemy. But outside of comic books, I'll say my mother as well, who has worked hard as a single mother to support me and my sister, just to get us through.
So my premise here is that organizers are superheroes. And of course, we know that moms are superheroes too. So obviously that makes you a double superhero in our eyes. So thank you for the work that you do. Do you have a favorite superhero?
Probably my mom, honestly. She's a boss. I don't know how she did it with four of us. I have just my one baby, and every day I'm like, oh my God, this is so hard. And my mom did this with four of us, and she did it with grace, and she kept us involved in the community and at school and all of the things. And she probably is certainly my superhero. I don't think I have like a fictional superhero.
I love that answer. I think you have a great answer.
I think my mom would take the cake.
So that's how Louisiana Lefty started. I hope you enjoyed this look back at season one. We'll have more great content exploring these political themes in season two, just hopefully with some better technology. Some of our loftier goals may be on hold until the world has tamed more of these crises. For now, we'll meet you back here every week to celebrate organizers, share the information that leads to winning campaigns, and have some fun with superheroes. Thank you for listening to Louisiana Lefty. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you to Ben Collinsworth for producing Louisiana Lefty, Jen Pack of Black Cat Studios for our Super Lefty artwork, and $1,000 Car for allowing us to use their swamp pop classic Security Guard as our Louisiana Lefty theme song.